Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. The Signature Symphony continues its season Saturday evening with a program of chamber music written by my guest today, composer Jared Impechachaha Tate, a citizen of the Chickasaw Nation who has devoted his craft to the development of an American Indian classical compositional idiom. His works often include stories from tribal traditions as inspiration or as narration, with a style that melds contemporary compositional techniques with indigenous songs and thematic material. His work has been commissioned and played by the San Francisco Symphony, the Buffalo Philharmonic, the National Symphony, the Santa Fe Chamber Festival, and the string quartet Ethel, just to name a few. In addition to his work as a composer, he's the artistic director of the Chickasaw Chamber Music Festival and composer in residence for the Chickasaw Summer Arts Academy. In 2009, Tate conceived, coordinated, and implemented a CD project, Ushtali, Music for String Quartet. The album consists of original compositions by his students from the Chickasaw Summer Arts Academy and is the first professional recording in history of works by young American Indian composers. Tate will be present at the concert and will talk about his music, along with narrating his string quartet, Moonstrike. The concert takes place this Saturday evening at the Van Tree Space at TCC's Southeast Campus at 7:30. Details on the concert at signaturesymphony.org. Jared Impechachaha Tate, welcome to Studio Tulsa. It's such a pleasure to speak with you.
Chukmashki. It's really good to speak to you, too.
This concert will feature three recent compositions, some that have premiered as late as this summer. What was the inspiration for, say, the two most recent pieces, Abitahanta and I believe it's Hozo, and I may be messing up those names. Mm-hmm. Tell me about those two pieces.
Well, Hozo is actually a Navajo word that is used by Navajos. It kind of means Navajo strong. They'll pair that Navajo strong phrase with it. Mm. And it's a word that indicates resilience and strength within the tribe. That was commissioned by Whitesnake Projects, which is an opera company in Boston. Cerise Jacobs is their artistic director, and they were commissioning many composers around the United States for shorter aria-type songs. And so for that one, I was actually paired with a librettist, Sofina Calderon, and actually she's a medical worker in Tuba City on the reservation, and she had written a kind of a poem account of what her experience was with treating COVID patients on the reservation. So they had paired me with her, and I wrote a dramatic work for soprano, cello, and piano that was based in her poetry for that event.
What struck you most about her poetry that you felt like this was something you wanted to set to music?
Sofina has a very high degree of humanity in her expression, and she is a very loving person in her community and very active and also very positive. I just really engage with her spirit, and she's a great family person and community person, and she just has a lot of positive outlook for the future of her tribe, and I really appreciate that because I feel the same way about mine. So I just felt, I just felt a real natural kinship with her.
When you see a text, how do you know what the right instrumentation was? In this case, you're using a soprano, obviously, you have poetry involved, but cello and piano. What spoke to you about that particular arrangement for this chamber music piece?
This is a really good question. And, you know, it's really funny. The answer is very pragmatic. It's what I was asked to write for. So a lot of people often say, so what made you choose to write for this instrument? It's like, well, the person commissioning it asked me to write a piece for their instrument. So I love their combination because all the pieces that they commissioned in this series were for piano, soprano, and cello. And, you know, that cello really helps in terms of adding a little bit more of a symphonic color and just color and drama. There's a little more drama that you can add to, a little more dimension you can give to it that I really appreciated. So that combination was just really great, very helpful to write for.
Often the cello has this beautiful singing tone. Is it almost like you have a male voice and then a female voice with a soprano and the cello sort of taking on could be a baritone or tenor range?
Absolutely. I totally agree with that. It creates this kind of a sonic balance between the two. And the piano does have very, very low notes, but the cello sings the low notes. And so the sustain that it gives is really helpful. But also the cello is incredibly diverse. So it can be very melodic and very rhythmic. And also its range is very wide. So it can play very high and very low. So there's a lot of possibilities with the cello that adds a lot of dimension to the orchestrations.
I would assume, since these poems are her reflection during COVID-19, which, of course, the Navajos experienced in the late spring and early summer of 2020, I assume this is a pretty new piece.
Yeah, it's about a year old now, and we did play this also at the Intermountain Opera Bozeman concert this last spring, and so I've been able to have it played there, which is really nice. And there's actually several performances of it scheduled during this next year, so it obviously has resonated with people, and I'm very grateful for that. I mean, that's what I want to do as a composer, is connect and, you know, share feelings with audience members and the singers, and the response from singers has also been very positive. So I'm very pleased about that. But also, you know, it's like Navajos are really impressive. I mean, they got hit pretty hard, but they also bounced back exceptionally well. I'm really proud of that community. You know, so it's just really inspiring to see their recovery story through COVID. It's been really, really cool.
Really, when you think of COVID, I think some of our tribal governments have been perhaps the best. I can think of the Lakota Nations up north, the Navajos. A number of other communities have basically done what is, I think, has become apparent from around the world, what's necessary to contain it, much better than other communities in this country and in other countries.
I'm very proud of Indian Country right now. Yes, we have really led the charge in a lot of different ways. In fact, my tribe as well, really. Our governor, Bill Anitubby, really set a very conservative and, I guess, almost, I don't want to say rigid, but just a real tight, he's run a real tight ship with this, and provided very, very well for our Chickasaw community in terms of vaccination availability and also medical care. I mean, we've been really robust, and you're right, it has been around, like this around Indian Country. I'm very proud of that. And also, to be honest with you, we've been through far worse. So we kind of have this in our wheelhouse, and I don't mean to say that to, you know, make other people feel bad about history. That's not where I'm going with that. What I'm saying is that we do have a history of resilience that I'm very proud of, and I really love the fact that I've seen Indian Country lean into our learned resilience.
Well, we'll look forward to hearing Hojo for solo, soprano, cello, and pianist. The other work is a work, actually this will be a theme on this concert, for solo violin and narrator. You use narrator a lot in some of your chamber music works.
All traditional cultures are cultures of storytelling, and so I lean into that a whole bunch in Indian Country. We have so many stories about so many things. It's really fun. I feel like a kid in a candy shop when it comes to storytelling. And I will say this, I am even more inspired since the birth of my son. He's 8 years old now, and I mean, I'm constantly reading him stories. He knows all these stories that I set to music, and he really loves them. So it's just something that just, that kind of resonance is really helpful in the household when I've got an 8-year-old kid who responds to that. But with this story is called Abatahanta, and it is about a warrior who thought he was really, really awesome, and he turns out to be not so great. So it's kind of subtitled The Warrior Who Was Not So Great. And it's basically, you know, a warrior who starts out very inflated in his ego, and then he comes to terms with that and becomes more humble and a more balanced leader for his tribe. And the way he does that is he encounters one of our ancient wood giants, wood creatures called Tlofa. And this is a very, very terrible creature to meet. And so he just thought he could just lick this creature with no problem. He just goes out in the forest by himself, just thinking he can do this. But he ends up getting whooped himself. And he does live to tell about it, but he lives to be a more balanced and thoughtful leader in the future. So it's really cute in that sense. And it's a really dynamic story because he's got such a diabolical personality. So as a composer, it's a lot of fun to lean into. And I really enjoyed that work. That work was commissioned by Katie Lansdale, who was one of my colleagues at the Cleveland Institute of Music. And she's a fabulous violinist. And we get along really well. She's also a very dynamic person. We're both dynamic people. And so this story just kind of fit what we were looking for. And she plays it a lot for the public, and she is having a blast with that right now.
Now, one of the things I noticed, now I've not heard that piece, but I did hear Moonstrike, which again features a narrator. And what I found was really how integrated your narration is with your music. Oftentimes, narration, when you think of things like Lincoln Portrait or Casey at the Bat or these recitations, and it's almost like the orchestra is sort of in a holding pattern while the recitation goes on, and then they play, and then the narration. But it seems like you really try to integrate your narration with the music as it's occurring.
That's correct. And, you know, I'll tell you, I am influenced very specifically by Stravinsky's Soldier's Tale. Mm. And also, you know, Peter and the Wolf is also very integrated as well. So those are two major narrative theatric works from two Russian composers. If you look at the parallel here, they were leaning into their own folk tales very heavily for those two stories. And I would say those are really good examples of what resonate with me. I love the fact that the narration is also part of the orchestration at times. Sometimes it's not, and sometimes it is. It's a real healthy combination, I feel, in those two compositions of Stravinsky and Prokofiev that have had an early impact on me.
Tell us a little bit about Moonstrike. Moonstrike was actually, again, it was a commissioned piece for the 50th mm-hmm. anniversary of the Apollo 11 landing. And it looks like you took that commission point and took it in your own direction. Tell us a little bit about this piece, Moonstrike.
Absolutely. Well, the Apollo Chamber Players in Houston commissioned this, of course. And this was part of a large series they had where they were commissioning 20 American composers. And oh my gosh, what a great project. And I was just so fortunate and blessed to be a part of this, round 19. I was the 19th composer. And of course, it was aligning with that. Well, Matt Dietrich, the first violinist, happens to be a very, very passionate space nerd like I am. And so he wanted something that had to do with the moon. And he was asking, are there American stories of the moon? And I said, in droves. There's so many. It's just great. And then also one thing that was just so much fun is he's like, do you happen to know any American Indian narrators? I'm like, yeah. And I said, in fact, Matt, I have a really good friend named John Harrington, who is a Chickasaw astronaut. And he's done stage performances before, and he's also a saxophonist, so he reads music. So John Harrington ended up premiering the narration. So we had an actual American Indian astronaut doing the narration for the premiere in Houston. So we were all kind of on cloud nine about that, and Matt is very happy about that result, and I'm so pleased. And in fact, John is on the professional recording that's coming out next year. So all that serendipity was just so much fun putting it together. And, you know, that's something that's so cool about commissions is that, you know, the relationship that we build with each other is really indicative of why we do this in the first place. I mean, just look at all these relationships that come out of it. It's really, really fun. And it just makes it even just more deep and valuable. So that was just a lot of fun how that all came together. And then, of course, you know, we're continuing the relationship because John performs it and he's doing the professional recording. And they now, of course, you know, John and Matt are really good friends, and it just all that closeness that came out of it is just really cool. So what I did is I chose three narrative stories. One is Kalispell, one is Isletus Pueblo, and one is Haida, from three very different parts of Indian country of the moon. And then it's bookmarked with an arrangement of a Calusa Seminole corn dance. And the reason I've chosen is because during the corn ceremony, that's usually during like a harvest moon, like a, you know, solstice moon. Mm-hmm. And so it's all very interconnected. And so they just gave me full license just to kind of, you know, pick the stories and abstract and have fun with that. And so that's the work.
Yeah. And you actually pair that with a different, you know, you take songs from different cultures and integrate that with them, like an Apache bird song, Choctaw hymn, mm-hmm. And a Haida song.
Yes, that's correct. And I always integrate American Indian culture and history and songs, rhythms, that kind of thing. And when I focus on different tribes, I always like match, obviously, the material with that tribe. And so you're hearing a multitude of different tunes that I've actually transcribed and reorchestrated within those works. And sometimes you'll hear them very clearly, the song that's being almost sung through the string. And then sometimes it's much more abstracted, kind of like, you know, Jackson Pollock even does, like super, I will like heavily abstract as well that melodic material throughout the work. But generally, especially with these pieces, you'll hear the remnants of those melodies coming back and, you know, in as the story is evolving.
Talk about how the moon is portrayed in, you know, a variety of cultures. Is it play a same role in most cultures, or does it have a different role in some cultures than others?
There is a great array of treatments throughout Indian country, but also throughout the world. One thing that I did notice, and this is in my narration, that it's really consistent throughout the cultures that the stories seem to be generated from coveting the moon, like wanting the power of the moon or wanting to own the moon or part of the moon. There's like this desire of its power that it has. And that seems to be rather consistent that I've read around different cultures around the world. And so I kind of lean into that. And sometimes that's treated as, you know, they can be very tragic stories. They can be trickster-like stories. There's a love story, of course, in this, the Isleta love story of the man who married the moon. But see, there's that attraction to the moon. And if you think about this historically, well, first of all, now the moon is beautiful. It's absolutely gorgeous. It is an amazing thing that we have that beautiful object in the sky that we get to see so clearly. I mean, the details of the moon are strikingly clear. And you can imagine back in the day when we didn't have the same technological knowledge, that moon, you can imagine the relationship and how close it felt. Like you can almost reach out and grab it, but you can't. And so you can imagine the old relationship that we as humans had with it was of feeling very close and distant at the same time. And so to me, it kind of makes sense that a lot of those stories were generated out of that feeling.
And it does have great power because it lights up the night. It, you know, it gives you, you know, actually, in a dark sky, a full moon, it gives you, you're able to see in the dark. Yeah.
It's incredible. And also it controls our weather and our, you know, tides. I mean, the moon has so much impact on us on a daily basis that we don't necessarily recognize, you know, every minute of the day.
Let's hear some music from Moonstrike. This is a piece for string quartet by my guest today, Jared Impechachaha Tate, with narration. This is the opening of Raven Steals the Moon.
Once was a village, they lived by the sea. They were fishermen and ate fish. There once was a bird named Raven, who was very lazy. Instead of fishing for himself, he followed the fishermen and ate their fish.
Caw, caw, caw,
he would say.
Gimme, gimme. Gimme!
He was always hungry. He was insatiable.
That's an excerpt from Moonstrike for String Quartet, one of three works to be performed by the Signature Symphony in their chamber concert this Saturday evening at 7:30 at the TCC Paste, written by my guest today, composer Jared Impechachaha Tate. Well, I was struck by something you just said a little bit ago of how you transcribed a lot of Choctaw hymns or a Haida play song or the Apache bird song. How much of that work has already been done, or how much of the work are you actually doing as really a musicologist putting these down in what we would say is traditional Western notation?
There's a combination there, and I will say there's not a lot that has actually been transcribed and preserved in notation. And so I am very aware of this, that every time I transcribe a new tune, generally it's the first time that tune has been transcribed. And so I have I'm creating a library of transcribed music. There is some music that's been transcribed throughout the past, and you can find those online. I mean, there were, you know, great historians and ethnomusicologists that went around, like, you know, Speck and Densmore and like Curtis even, and they did transcriptions. And there are some books, this is a handful of books that have transcriptions of different tunes from around the Indian country. And I will say, by and large, they're done quite well. But the problem is that we don't hear people singing along with that. And so there's that issue. But I am contributing to that repertoire.
And I'd assume that in a lot of cultures, it's very difficult to get the notation exactly the way the song has been sung through generation and oral tradition. I would assume that's pretty difficult.
Well, you know, I think that one thing that a lot of Americans will relate to is the constant dilemma of notation in jazz.
Right.
So like the basic swing notation is always a topic of constant conversation with people about how the notation itself does not indicate style. And that's the same way in Indian country. Of course, when you're talking about, you know, 500 different tribes around the United States, well, I mean, there's all that style. But, you know, that's an issue that goes back throughout human history, and that is style is only acquired through listening. You can't put it in notation. So far, there's just no way to, you have to hear it. And so no matter what it is, whether it's classical music or symphonic music or traditional music of any kind from around the world, bluegrass, I mean, my gosh, you can imagine the amount of styles of bluegrass that are constantly talked about between bluegrass players. You know, there's regional styles and it breaks down to family styles. It's really complex, but that's human history. We are complex people. So yes, you're bringing up a really great topic, and I love talking about this with people, but the only way that you can really understand it is if you hear it.
Well, a lot of those traditions you mentioned, you learn by hearing it and sitting along and learning that way, not from opening a book of music and learning it that way. There's right. just too many nuances.
Correct. Yeah. But, you know, I mean, basically, you know, we live in an age where, I mean, obviously we have things notated and there's written down and everything, and we have technology. So, I mean, there's always going to be kind of a hybrid at the end. And so it's really nice to have things. It's nice to have all those in your wheelhouse of reference. And so it is absolutely helpful. But again, it's like to hear it and see the notation, you know, at the same time, that's kind of like the ultimate goal.
My guest today is Jared Impechachaha Tate, a Chickasaw composer. Very busy right now because I know you have a lot of commissions going on, and it looks like all of a sudden you're being asked to do a lot of concerti. I know you just premiered a concerto recently, and then you've got two in the works, and they're for instruments that don't often get concertos written for them. I believe it's bassoon and trombone are the next two, and I think you had a flute concerto earlier, if I'm not mistaken. So tell me about the process of writing a concerto for an instrument that doesn't really have all that much written for it. With an orchestra.
Well, the bassoon concerto, fortunately, premiered last year with the Dallas Symphony. I'll tell you, I was lucky because it was just 2 weeks before we all shut down. I'd done that, and then I had an appearance with the San Francisco Symphony. It's right in time for that. So the bassoon concerto was a really nice success, and now that's being performed again here with the Oklahoma City Philharmonic in the spring. And the bassoon concerto came about because the principal of the Dallas Symphony is Ted Saluri, and he and I are also old friends from the Cleveland Institute of Music, and he's performed on my chamber works before down at the Santa Fe Chamber Music Festival, liked my writing and said, I'd really like to commission a bassoon concerto for you. And so that took several years, actually, for it to come together, and so finally we premiered it with the Dallas Symphony. The bassoon is a favorite instrument of mine. I love it. And so I had a really easy time personally expressing myself through the bassoon. And that was very paired culturally with the story that I had picked, which is the ghost of the white deer. So that image of the deer was what I was working with. And if you hear like the deer call in the forest, well, I mean, it doesn't sound exactly like the bassoon playing classical music, but the timbre is really close. And so I romanticized that deer call sound through the bassoon playing. So that was kind of my cultural and sonic match with the two instruments. And of course, I'm abstracting and romanticizing that. So what you hear is a very abstracted and romanticized Jared version of the pairing of the bassoon with that deer's singing voice.
I just realized what you're writing now is a trombone concerto and a violin concerto. That's exactly what's coming up. Same thing?
Those are coming up. Those are two pieces that are in the works. And for both of those, I'm also just leaning very heavily into Chickasaw culture. The trombone concerto will be about our thunder beings of the forest, and so it's going to be a very elemental piece for that. There's a lot you can do with the trombone. Again, it's like these instruments are very dynamic instruments, and these days the trombone players, you know, it's like every 10 years it's like a different section of the orchestra just kicks it up a notch, and the trombone is one of those instruments that has really kicked up. They can sound like French horns these days. Their tone is unbelievable, and their ranges are expanding more and more, both low and high. So there's, again, so much expression available through the trombone. And, of course, you can imagine, you know, if I'm focusing on the elements, well, there's an entire brass section that can pair with the trombone. So I'm having a lot of fun with those ideas right now. So and then the violin concerto. Violin is another great dramatic instrument, and I'm romanticizing aspects of Chickasaw life through that violin concerto. So it's almost like the concerto is like a day in the life of Chickasaws 2,000 years ago. And that's kind of what I'm kind of theatrically focusing on that for the violin concerto.
I'm struck by something you've said. You said, you know, I'm lucky that this is being performed again and again. And I know I've talked to a number of composers over the years. And for a long time, the scourge of composers was you got commissions, you got premieres, But then the piece would never be played. It seems like you've been very lucky that other people are, you know, you haven't fallen for that. And I think in general, contemporary music is being performed more often. And it doesn't matter that you're not premiering a piece as opposed to, say, 15, 20 years ago. How important is that to have those additional performances? What do you learn about the piece? Or is it just a matter of seeing that something you've spent a great deal of time is bringing joy to more people?
You know, it's been, honestly, it's been kind of a mixed bag. There have been phases of modern art that are different in, at different times of history. And I mean, there were modern composers in the past who were very famous. Like John Cage was played a lot when he was writing. He was the most played composer of his time. I mean, he was extremely famous and he was extremely modern. So it does happen. Look, Puccini was performed a lot and he was a very modern opera composer. So this, I mean, it's kind of a combination. And so I will say, you know, in my career, it's been a nice constant increase. So when I was younger, I wasn't played as much. And now as I grow older, I'm played more. And so I just feel like it's been kind of a natural curve and a natural wish for mine. And I feel like this is the time because I'm a more mature composer. So I prefer that these works are played more often, you know. And so the answer I'm giving you is kind of a balanced answer of absolutely, we all want our music to be played as much as humanly possible because we want to connect with our live audiences today while we're alive. And I do think that ensembles go through different phases. I think you're right about the trend that's happening. There's more turn to modern music. That, and I believe it's echoing the fact that we have an enormous amount of living composers today. It's really, I would say, unprecedented. We have a lot of new music being written, and I think it's fabulous. And so I think because of that, there's a lot more attention being being given to modern music.
And I think also today's contemporary music in Western art music, it doesn't require a lot of hearings to understand it. I mean, maybe you can get more complexities the more you hear it, but it's readily accessible upon first, second hearings. And I think that's important, too.
You know, I'll tell you, I give a lot of credit to that for the commercial film and music industry. At this point, all audiences have heard the most modern possible music available in movie scores. It's all there. And I mean, it's literally all of the above in movie scores these days. And in all commercial music, it's everywhere. And with the boom of all the, you know, the streaming, not only have actors had a great boom of employment, but there's a lot of composers in media today, and they're pulling all the stops in all the types of music that's going on. So the good news is that audiences are constantly exposed to the most modern music available.
Well, we look forward to hearing the concert this Saturday with chamber music, a string quartet, Moonstrike for String Quartet being the centerpiece of the program, featuring the music of my guest today, Jared Impechachaha Tate. It's been such a pleasure, Jared. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you so much. Chukmashki, Yakoke.
Composer Jared Impechachaha Tate speaking with us about his music here on Studio Tulsa. The member of the Chickasaw Nation will be featured in a chamber music concert by the Signature Symphony Saturday evening at 7:30 at the TCC Pace. For information, visit signaturesymphony.org. We're going to leave you with music by Tate. Studio Tulsa is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.